Willkommen zum Faster You Podcast, wo sich alles um Ausdauersport und Training dreht. Hier geben euch Sebastian Schlurike, Björn Kafka und Niklas Hanker wertvolle Tipps und Einblicke, die euch helfen, eure Performance auf das nächste Level zu bringen. Okay, welcome to a new episode of a Faster You Podcast. Today with Björn Kafka and Jamie, aerodynamic expert at Visma Leasebike, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yeah, nice. It's I know Jamie Loden for a longer time, but I think our listeners don't. So maybe you can give us a little background of how you became an aerodynamic specialist. So how's your story?
Yeah, so I'm I guess you'd say like in charge of aerodynamic engineering within Visma. Mm-hmm. So this is a role I've been doing since September last year. Mm-hmm. So I'm quite new to the role, but as Bjorn said, I've been working with Aerotune or Faster You for quite a long time. Before I was working at Visma, I was working with a small company in the UK called Wattshop, who make aerodynamic equipment, so time trial extensions, crank sets, etc. But also offer consulting, so aerodynamic consulting, so aero testing, which is how I started working with a Faster You. So that was, I think, even as long ago as 2021, maybe, or even before then. Wow. But yeah, for quite a long time. So when Faster You was still quite new, so I was like one of the first significant users, I guess you would say.
yes.
quite a long history of helping to develop the software. Maybe not doing like the software side of things, but definitely as a user case.
Yeah. But then,
going back even longer than that, though, I was previously I was sort of a cyclist, like not professional, but I tried my best. But at the same time, I was also an engineer in the oil industry, so doing quite a lot of fluid modeling and implementation of sensors and understanding the limitation of sensors within the oil industry. So, like combining that side of things with my cycling history, then kind of led into working with Wattshop in 2020, I think it was.
Yeah. So turning from the dark side to a more environmentally friendly side.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, like, I saw. Yeah, you also cycled. I saw that you did the tour of Zsa Zsa twice, and that was a few days ago. Yeah. So if I look back at aerodynamics, and I think that's. Because I'm older, always when I look back at how it started, the first thing that comes into my mind is Francesco Moser. Yeah, and a few years ago, I was beside this bike he was riding when he did the 1 hour world record, which is a crazy bike. Yeah, it's like the rear wheel is it's like my size. Yeah, and the one question I always ask myself. When I look at Francesco Moser or Graham Aubrey or Chris Boardman, they did testing and how they did it before power meters. So were they in a wind tunnel or do you know that?
I don't know. I think a lot of it is having an understanding of fluid dynamics anyway. So it's not necessarily having the empirical data. It's like applied understanding. That if you can reduce your size, you're going to go faster. I think Chris Boardman actually at one point was taking photos of himself on the tub or like on a trainer from the front and then just cutting out the shape and then weighing the shape to get an idea of the size of it. So yeah, it's not super accurate, but it still gives you a nice idea of how to reduce the area.
It's still like you can now you can
still measure something. So yeah, they were optimizing. I think both like Aubrey and Boardman were optimizing for A, let's say within CDA. Still interesting to do, but yeah, actually like the CD part of things is a lot more complicated.
Yes. I mean, like today you can do it with your telephone. Yeah, taking a picture, a weighted picture, and then you have a software that. Gives you kind of an area, the first time I really mentioned aerodynamic was, of course, when Greg LeMond won the Tour de France. It was like from the track suddenly it was on the road, and this was really something, yeah. And but the main thing, especially as a German, was when Uli Schoberer started with developing the SRM power measurement. And I know when I saw it was a documentary, Team Telekom, of course, yeah, they were quite big. Bjarne Riis won the tour, and then they were starting testing. Yeah, and I think that was more or less the first time when someone took the advantage of a power meter and was testing on a track. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So as soon as you've got a power meter, you can basically start doing aero testing. You can look at the ratio between the power that you're putting in and then the speed that you're getting out. Yeah. So the energy in and the energy out. And then from that, you can try to optimize. So you put less energy in and you go faster. It's really as simple as that. Yeah. Once you start getting into the finer details, then you need to have a detailed understanding of like the equations and the mathematics going on in the background. But really all you're trying to do is go faster with less power.
Yeah. Yeah. If I look back, 1996 and 7, when Bjarne won and Ulrich, and then it seems like there was kind of a very slow development in aerodynamics. Yeah. For example, if you look how Armstrong and all these other guys sat on the bike, and we still had the understanding of a power meter. I think the boundary was really pushed when teams like Sky started with like a way more approached or a more scientific approach to test aerodynamics. Or what's your opinion about that?
Yeah, I think like cycling traditionally has been quite a conservative sport, and that things have always been done one way. Because they've always been done that way, and to try to encourage change is harder. There's also there were bigger wins to be had than aerodynamics for quite a long time, certainly through like the 80s, 90s, 2000s. That you didn't need to look after, didn't need to look for like five watts because you could find 50 watts somewhere else. But certainly, as that kind of era has come to a close, the improvements since then have been the improvements in aerodynamics and in equipment have been pretty significant. So it's like a trade-off, almost like trying to find some gains which you would have had through illegal means previously, but they are actually, you can still make these sort of improvements in performance, but you just need to really sweat the details, and it takes a lot more work, and you need a lot more of like an open-minded culture. So that's both like within the team and within the riders themselves need to understand that. But I think even if you go back, I'm trying to remember the tour. I can't remember, but like 2000s, maybe 2007, 2008, you had some riders who were riding with really high hands.
Floyd Landis, yeah?
Floyd Landis, yeah, exactly.
Yes. The mentis position, everyone was laughing about it. And it was interesting, yeah, because he did it because he had pretty bad problems with his hip, and I think he also had like a replacement. Yeah. And so he opened up his angle, and then the position was very aerodynamic, yeah? So,
But as well, it's about having the information so that like at the time, everybody would laugh at him because there's no way of quantifying the improvement gains. So it looks different, but that means we're just going to laugh at you rather than, it's actually faster because we have the data. And at that time, no one was doing any testing. Well, now we can do aerodynamic testing we do aerodynamic testing on our TT bikes for all our riders. Yeah. And we can say that the individual riders, like some of them, you can have big gains by having higher hands or by having narrower elbows, etc. And then others, you can also share information which is maybe at first doesn't appear so useful, but actually is really nice to know. Like testing last week, we had a rider where stack height didn't really make a significant difference. So they're quite a small rider. They're quite narrow. Mm-hmm. And actually being higher or lower on the front was essentially negligible. Mm-hmm. So then you say, okay, in which case then we'll go really high with stack height because... Mm-hmm. We're not losing anything, and you can have a much more relaxed position, and as a result, have greater power output. But that's still quite an actionable insight. And in the past, like you'd see someone small with a really high stack height, you'd say like, why are you doing that? Like obviously as someone tiny, you want to get really low, just make yourself as small as possible.
I think
it's not always that way.
Yeah, I think this is one of the main misunderstandings in aerodynamics. You see a picture or something on the TV live, and you see like, he's not aerodynamic at all. Yeah, to get an aerodynamic idea of someone sitting on a bike. Of course, you are experienced, but a lot of people always think, okay, you have to sit as low as possible. Yeah, as Chris Boardman, yeah, having the handlebar.
Yeah.
ridiculous
on the front wheel. Yeah.
Yes, on the front wheel, shaving himself, his chin. At least. I think the same. So that was really nice, yeah, because I want to always look at the development and how long it took, like, to where we are now. Yeah, and of course, we talk a little bit of the future. But for our listeners who are not really familiar with the fundamentals of aerodynamics, yeah, so what are we doing? Yeah, why is aerodynamics so significant? Why is it so important? What happens at what speed?
Yeah.
Things like that.
So, essentially, if you break down like cycling, yeah, as a discipline into like the engineering principles of it, you have your energy in, which is you're turning the pedals, you're driving the chain, you're providing energy to the system, and then that energy is going into making you move forward, but it's being lost in like three or four significant places.
Yeah.
So you have rolling resistance on the tires. So as you go faster, you have increased rolling resistance. At low speeds, that's quite significant. At high speeds, it's a much lower percentage of your total power is going into overcoming rolling resistance. But it's not insignificant, but it's a lower, slightly lower importance than aerodynamics anyway at higher speeds. So you have rolling resistance, you have some power which is lost into the chain, so into like drive chain efficiency. So you have the bearings and bearings chain losses, like basically within the system itself. So if you're going at, let's say, 40 kilometers an hour, rolling resistance might be 25 watts. Your efficiency might be 3 to 5 watts. If you have a really dirty chain, it might be 15 watts. But if you have a wax chain, ceramic bearings, you're probably looking at 3 to 5 watts, more or less. You have climbing. So if you're going uphill, like that becomes really significant. But generally for aerodynamics, we focus more on the flat. And then you have aerodynamics. And the reason why aerodynamics is so important is that the power required to drive yourself through the air, essentially, it increases with the cube of your velocity.
Yeah.
So if you double your velocity, the power required to go through the air goes up by 8 times.
Mm-hmm.
So at low speeds, like 20 kilometers an hour, it's really not, maybe lower than that, like 15 kilometers an hour, it's really not very significant. But by the time you get to 40 kilometers an hour, it's really, really important. And it's probably taking like upwards of 80-85% of your total power is going into aerodynamics. And then by the time you're going crazy fast, like say 60 kilometers an hour, 65 kilometers an hour in a sprint, like you're talking well over 90% of your power is going into aerodynamics. So that's why we focus so much on the faster events, so things like time trials, for example, time trials and triathlons, where aerodynamics have a really big importance, and traditionally haven't focused so much on climbing position, let's say, because obviously you're going a lot slower and it's a much smaller percentage of your total power losses.
Definitely. But we see, for example, if I take I have two things in mind when Jonas won the tour, especially at this amazing time trial. He was sitting in his time trial position, and I recalculated that, and actually the position was the thing that made the difference, being able to push the power in an aerodynamic position. So as you mentioned, if you go 25 kilometers an hour, you still have an advantage, even going uphill in a time trial position, if you go from a CDA, 0.2 or even lower, to 0.3 something.
Certainly at the speed that Jonas goes uphill, there's there's a big advantage. It's just whether or not he can, yeah, he can still get the power.
Yes.
Do the same power. So there's always a compromise. So that's one of the things, yes, that we try to focus on here as well with the riders is we do the testing, but then we share the results with them, but we make sure that they understand that there's always a compromise that, yeah, maybe this position is 3 watts faster aerodynamically, but then it's something that they can then go away. So it's an iterative process. So they go away and they say, like, yeah, if I ride in this position, I have no power loss, or
yes,
if I go away in this position, I have a significant power loss. And it's, yeah.
What's your take on really train yourself into this position? Yeah, I mean, like, if you have a very aggressive position and the rider says, okay, I it's impossible to ride that, yeah, but if we do, of course, now we have winter and the tour is far away, it seems, yeah, like, yeah, and you say, okay, we'll just go and train. Yeah, I still remember in the lab I worked, we did a study with cyclists and changing their position and measuring their gross efficiency, and then we did it again after a month, and it was quite interesting because they, of course, adapt to the position, yeah, even to a very aggressive position. So what's your take on that?
I think that, yeah, but for sure you can adapt to a position given enough time, but I think as well that there are going to be limitations in the individual physiology, which, yeah, there'll be cutoff points where it doesn't really matter how much training you'll do, you'll never adapt to it. So yeah, that's sort of why it's important to think of, yeah, aero testing in a longer term than like 2 or 3 hours on the velodrome. It's, yeah, you do need to get like understanding, such as like, say, like lower is faster, let's say, for some riders, but it's not the case for everyone. But imagine you had someone where it was, yeah, you go lower on the front, then you will be more aerodynamic, but then it's something that they can then go and work on and then see if they see themselves in their own training that there's like a break point where they can't necessarily go any lower despite, yeah, yeah, lots and lots of adaption. And I think that that's going to be more of like a physiological like boundary, essentially, that at some point they start to restrict blood flow or similar, like, yeah, or they can't breathe properly anymore. Yeah. But I think until those points, you can more or less adapt to. I'd like to think you can adapt to anything.
Yeah,
it's definitely the message that I tried. It's definitely the message that I tried to push. Whether it's entirely true or not is a little bit different. But yeah, certainly keen to get the riders to try, yeah, to adapt to almost anything.
Even if they ride children's bike cranksets on, yeah, their bikes. Yeah. So if we're talking about testing aerodynamics, there are a lot of things, how to do that and how to achieve that. So maybe you can just tell us how it's done today. Yeah.
Yeah. So to actually test the aerodynamics, so we're trying to, so within, yeah, so if you look at the equation, essentially, so the mathematics of it, you have your power in, you have your speed out, and then, yeah, within that you have two parameters which are fairly important. So you have the air density, but the air density is, yeah, is what it is, and then you have the CDA, which is like a measure of the aerodynamic properties of the object. So in our case, yeah, the cyclist. So CDA is, A is like the frontal area. So if you, like we mentioned with Chris Boardman, if you take a photo of the rider from the front, you cut it out, that gives you the area. And then CD is it's like a measure of how the airflow, how the air flows over the object. So it's the shape factor, and that's a lot harder to measure accurately. So generally, as a whole, we try to measure CDA. So this is probably a parameter that you've heard of, and we can kind of do that in two main ways. So either you can do it in a wind tunnel, where you put bike and a rider, or just a bike, or just a wheel, or yeah, an object into the wind tunnel. You have the air coming at a fixed speed, and then you measure the deflection of a force plate underneath. So you measure the forces on the object, and then from that you can determine the CDA. Or we do it in the velodrome, and in the velodrome we measure speed, we measure power, and then from that we can calculate the CDA. So there's benefits to both systems. Certainly the wind tunnel is a lot more precise than velodrome testing. It's a lot easier to control, like the rider position. For example, if the rider is sat on a bike inside the wind tunnel, then he's the other side of a window from the person running the session. So you can see if they're changing their position significantly. But at the same time, in the wind tunnel, the rider is not actually riding anywhere. Like, he might be pedaling, he might be pushing 200 watts, but they're not going anywhere. They haven't got to steer. They haven't got to look around corners. It's really easy to get yourself in a position which is not realistic, which is not sustainable in the real world. So generally would say that wind tunnel testing is great for making very small changes to position and seeing if that, if you can save like one or half a watt even in very small changes. But it's also good for testing equipment. So if you want to test wheels, you want to test frames, you want to test helmets, skin suits, the wind tunnel is excellent for that. It's very easy to vary the speed, very easy to vary the yaw angle. So you get a good understanding of relative performances of equipment. But actually for making big changes to rider position, the velodrome is definitely the best place to be doing that. And velodrome aero testing, I think, has quite a long history, at least going back to 2010, I think, maybe even before that. There was a system from Garmin called Alphamentis. Actually, no, it wasn't from Garmin. It was called Alphamentis.
Yes.
Yeah, it was called Alphamentis, and then Garmin bought it. So that was a system which has been used, for at least 15 years. I did some aero testing, I think, in 2013 or 2014 in the UK. It's certainly come on now. And one of the big issues, at least with velodrome testing, is that there's quite a lot of things that can go wrong. You have quite a lot of sensors. You have quite a lot of data. Velodrome time is quite expensive, so you want to progress quickly. You want to do the testing that you have planned. And you want to look at the results as you go, because then you can make changes which are sensible and ignore the changes which aren't. And that's always sort of one of the limitations in the past, was that the analysis took a long time. Things went wrong really easily. You ended up wasting a huge amount of time. And that was really one of the reasons why my previous position, we were really happy to work with a FastU, because that you guys had built the platform first before thinking about too much else. It was the dashboard and how you interacted with the system, which was the priority. And it was just about simplifying the user experience of it. The mathematics behind it all, is solid, and that was developed over a couple of years as well. But just the user experience was so much easier that you could really do a lot of testing. So, for example, this week we did some aero testing with some of the Visma riders, and we had two riders on the track, and we were able to do more than 20 runs, I think, within 4 hours. And in the past, that was just impossible, because at the end of each run, you would do 5-10 minutes of data processing. You'd find out that maybe you didn't press start properly, or that your power meter wasn't working, or that your speed sensor wasn't quite capturing right. But you wouldn't find that out until after the run. And that's what's really nice with the systems now, is that you can see live data coming in. You have live interpretation of the data. So again, if someone is doing a run, if someone's doing a run in a certain position, we'll get data for around 2 to 3 minutes. But we can see after 10 seconds if the data's not recording properly. Yeah. And then we can call the rider in, rather than having them ride for 3 minutes at quite high power, come in and then tell them that you screwed up. And they've got to go again. It's not brilliant. But you can just do so much more testing now. And that lets you explore a lot more different avenues than you would have done previously. And I think that's really the key.
Now it sounds easy, but still it's testing. It's also, if you like, do a test in a lab, physiological testing, you still need to know a little. We always see that. So it's not like, okay, I push a button and then I go, and people always come with all the equipment and helmets and wheels, and they just say, okay, now I will do aero testing. I always say, be patient, really understand how it works. And the first thing is, of course, know the system. But if I test, the first thing I do is, what is the main thing you are looking at? Yeah, if you test, yeah, before I tell you what I usually do. So what what is really the thing that drives the CDA low? Yeah. And going down. So what is the most important thing? People always think like I have to invest €2,500 in a wheel set. Yeah.
No, definitely not. So you can have much bigger improvements in body position.
Yeah.
So this is the same whether it's on a TT bike, if it's on a road bike, even a mountain bike. If you can make small changes to your position, you can have quite large improvements in performance. Certainly, like, many orders of magnitude bigger than you can have with making small changes to like wheel depth, for example. Optimizing body position is absolutely key. The other things are kind of consider them for free a little bit. So if we can optimize helmet choice or skin suit or overshoes or wheels, it's like it's not affecting the rider too much. Mm-hmm. But yeah, body position can make a huge difference. Like easily, like small changes can be looking at like 30-40% changes in power output, which is huge.
Is there a kind of a rule of thumb where you would say, okay, if you do this, this will absolutely improve your aerodynamics?
Not really.
On both, yeah, on the ball, on the time trial bike and on the road bike.
On a road bike, obviously, if you get yourself low on the front, you squeeze your shoulders a little bit, tuck yourself into what's like perceived aerodynamic position, it will be significantly faster than if you're sat upright. Beyond that, there's really, I'd say, very little which is consistent from rider to rider. It's really difficult to say. Like you when you do aero testing, you start to realize that maybe 60-70% of the time I can make a change and it will work, but also there are certain changes which I'm sure will be a significant improvement, and we make it and it makes absolutely no difference, or it makes it slower. So it's really quite unknown, and testing is it's really, really important. But like you said as well, that it's still not an easy process. It's still the process itself is it's quite important to get it right, to be consistent in how you're running a session. So making one change so that you understand, only change one variable each time so you understand what you changed. So rather than like getting on your bike, doing some aero testing and then changing everything and doing it again, because okay, then you find out if you're faster or you're slower, but you don't understand why you're faster or you're slower. So you can't really work with that going forward. So we always try to change one thing at a time. So if you're changing position, for example, like on a TT bike, maybe we would change stack height, or you would change reach, or you would change width, or we'd change angle. But only ever one thing at a time, so that you start to get an understanding of the parameters which actually impact performance and those which don't.
Yeah. So usually you really play, or you really work a lot on the position, long time, and then maybe putting a helmet or maybe changing the helmets. But this also can mess up a lot, and you are always uncertain if maybe this helmet would be faster in that position. Yeah, so it's you really need to have a kind of a concept how to test. Maybe changing the helmet in between always and things like that. Yeah,
it's always a trade-off between the time that you have available and the how you're going to get best value for your time. So actually being in a world tour team makes that a little bit easier, because we have like one or two helmets that we can actually use for time trials. So it makes the testing a little bit easier. But certainly like a time trial helmet has quite a big impact on the aerodynamics, but also on the position that works with that helmet. So if you had an infinite amount of time, you would test every helmet with every skin suit in every position, but that's not an effective use of time. You'd spend a huge amount of time doing that, and you would find a system which was maybe half a watt faster than the other best system. And there's better ways of using that time. So at least within Visma, we have good equipment as it is, so we can test with the big Giro helmet and we can optimize a position for that. But it's definitely interesting that if we optimize a position for the large Giro helmet, Then we go back to the previous version of the Giro helmet. We see quite a big drop off in performance. But if we make the same change on a position which has been optimized with the original Giro helmet, then the difference is a lot smaller between the helmets. So it's like you can build a position which is faster around the new one, but it's not necessarily the same position as you would have had with the old helmet. So this is why the process is quite important. So you need to really have an understanding of the parameters which impact your performance, which is why we try to change just one variable for each run that we do.
How important is, I mean, like, time trialing is of course a huge part in cycling, but compared to a Grand Tour, yeah, I mean, like, we have maybe two stages and maybe a prologue, and so the road bike becomes, I think, a very important thing to test too, yeah, and I'm talking about that for many years now. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, so it's definitely something which teams are looking at more and more now. In the past, yeah. In the past, no one did any aero testing, and then it was TT testing. And now you start to gain an understanding of the improvements that are possible. Even riding around in the peloton, where you might be doing 200 watts for 3 hours in the beginning of a stage, if you can save 5 watts there, there's still quite a big reduction in energy consumption. And at the moment, yeah, within the professional peloton, there's quite a big focus on energy usage and on replacing calories. So if you can reduce your energy expenditure, you can try to manage your calories a little bit better. But it, also in road bike, in mass start events, there's always a time when, if you want to win, there's always a time when you're in the wind.
Yeah.
Either you're going for a long solo breakaway, in which case, trying to optimize your position there is better because you'll go faster. So having at least an understanding of whether riding on the tops is faster, whether riding in the drops is faster, how you can hold your body. So maybe it's not something that you can hold for 40 minutes, but it's like a position that you can hold for 2 minutes and then stretch, then go back into it again. Or if you're sprinting, knowing like the body position in the sprint, or if you're in a lead out, knowing how to position yourself for the lead out. But it's, at least in terms of equipment as well, you can start to look at like different race scenarios. So in the Tour de France last year, for example, you had the stage where, is it the stage into over the Glibier into Valoire, I think it was, where Pogacar attacked like the last 200 meters from the top of the Glibier, and then it's a downhill descent.
Yes.
So
yeah.
The descent is like 70 kilometers an hour, 70, 80 kilometers an hour. So really optimizing for aerodynamics is hugely important. So that's not just in his position, but also in the equipment that he's using. But there's, definitely an understanding now that you can optimize in these areas, and you can have quite significant improvements if possible.
Yeah. So, I mean, like a few years ago, when they started building aero frames, like Scott with the foil, yeah, was really like the first one I noticed, and that was actually a pretty good one. I still have it. So if you look only material, yeah, not position wise, so on the bike, so what is really what brings the best value for reducing the CDA, yeah? Is it the frame, is it the wheels, of course, or maybe we play a scenario, something like a classic race with a lot of wind, yeah, from the side and everything. So what is making the difference, what's your opinion on that?
I think it very much depends on the scenario, the rider themselves. They're like baseline equipment, but wheels, frames, skin suit, even a helmet on a road bike, these can all have quite a large impact. Even down to your tire choice and the size of your tire. It's without testing, it's difficult to know for sure. But certainly, in like crosswind environments, the aerodynamic differences become really significant. So actually, let's say like a kind of flat stage through France in July where it's quite warm, everyone's in their race suit. There's nothing too complicated going on. There's no wind. The differences between teams is quite small. Differences between equipment choices is quite small in terms of aerodynamic performance. But it's when you get into, like I say, more stressful environments, so you have high crosswinds or you have cold weather, for example, then you can start to find really significant differences. Generally, you would find that deeper section wheels will perform better aerodynamically in crosswinds, but then you also have a trade-off in handling. Mm-hmm. So they'll be more aerodynamic and they'll have a bit of a sailing effect, but if there's a variable wind, then they've become almost impossible to handle. So it's always, again, like it's an iterative process trying to understand exactly what works when and what doesn't work when. So last year in a few races, we used a front disc wheel. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you have a really stable light crosswind, then it's absolutely amazing. Like it just acts like a sail. It takes you along really sweet. But if you have any variable wind at all, then it becomes almost impossible to handle.
Yeah.
So that's when the wind tunnel actually is quite useful to get that kind of data to have an understanding on the performance of these items, because velodrome testing is quite limited to essentially 0 degrees of your, more or less 0 degrees of your, just like the wind is coming straight on at you.
It would have been interesting to see Wout at the Olympic Games with better weather conditions. I mean, like the rain was messing up a lot. Yeah, you can't go really fast in the cornering. And, I mean, like, I was at the women's race, which was horrible.
Yeah.
the American rider or the women in the women's field who crashed like four times. It was a shame to see that. So what is interesting for me is of course wheels are for me it's a no-brainer. You really feel the effect if you have crosswinds. You feel that you're going faster, and I still remember riding one of the first aero wheels that Lightweight produced. They were called Autobahn, and they were impossible to handle. It was horrible. If you had a side wind or crosswind, you really have to push, and then if there was a tree, the wheel was really doing something very weird. It was the first time I felt afraid of riding in wind, and I never did that because I grew up at the coast. And then I know, okay, but the wheels are getting way better. The frames, I'm still like, when I was racing, I think my first bike was a Basso Gap, which was a steel frame. And I'm still like, oh, they I think they were quite fast, yeah. But if we look at the profiles now from the frames, is there a big significant difference in the frames? Are they really improving the speed?
Yes, absolutely. So it's not even just the aerodynamics of the frames as well, but it's also the stability of them. Mm-hmm. So it's something which I've really noticed since I've got on the Cervelo S5. It's just so stable. Like you can be going downhill at 70, 80 kilometers an hour. You can have like side winds coming through, but you can still be putting things in your pockets. Like it just doesn't move with changes in crosswinds, which is really nice. But you talked then about having a steel bike, an old steel bike. And actually I had, previously I did some aero testing with somebody who had, there's an American frame builder called Rob English, mm-hmm. who makes really nice steel bikes, like definitely worth looking him up. But he made really nice time trial bikes, all steel tubing, all like profiled so that it looks aero, but not really any testing done on it. But it looks really aero, it looks really smart. And I had someone who came in who had one of these bikes. And he also had something else like a Trek Speed concept or something like that. And you'd look at them and say, yeah, its position was quite similar on both bikes. Right, they both look like, obviously the Trek looks like a modern TT bike, but the other one that just looked like a really like old school, but really aero bike.
Yeah.
And he was just interested, like, is there a difference between them? So we did the testing and it's like at 45 kilometers an hour, it's like 30 watts of difference. And it's just absolutely mental. Like it's just huge, huge variation between the two. It's just quite a nice to see that even something which like it looks pretty sweet is actually like compared to the modern bikes where they've been designed with CFD modeling and like hours and hours in the wind tunnel, there is really big difference.
It's like cars from the 60s, they all have this round shapes and they used to be like, oh, they are very aero, but they use a lot of gasoline to get
absolutely yeah, just because something looks good, it doesn't mean it necessarily is.
So how to destroy your aerodynamics on the bike, yeah? Especially in miserable weather conditions, yeah? Putting on a rain jacket or a vest, how much influence does it have?
Rain jacket can be horrific. If you're riding fast, like easily 60 or 70 watts more required to go the same speed. But like you can see, if you try to, like, something which is that big, you don't need to go to a velodrome to do aero testing. You can do that out on the open road.
Yes.
Like you can ride a stretch of road at 40 kilometers an hour in like an aero-ish position, and then put your rain jacket on and try and do the same and see how much harder it is, or see how impossible it is. Gilet should be a bit better than a rain jacket, but mm-hmm. at the same time, maybe you get cold, then you have no power at all.
Yeah.
So you need to keep warm. Destroying, as a way to destroy your aerodynamics, a rain jacket is pretty good.
I still remember I had this old riffraff rain jacket that was was like a parachute. horrible. What we do is also we test, or the riders test themselves, yeah, on the outdoor test, and that gives them a pretty good understanding of course the positioning, but also on what kind of jerseys or rain jackets or stuff they should wear. And even having a toolbox at the seat post made one rider fast, and he was really shocked, and he was like, I can't ride with that thing in the race. It looks shit. And the very good summer jersey they had in their one team, and then the cheap one was actually the way better jersey. So it's really sometimes...
really interesting about doing the testing is that it throws up these results sometimes, and you're just like, I don't understand why that is. But if it happens in the wind tunnel, you can kind of like be like, oh, that's kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you should look at that more. But if you're actually testing on the road or testing in the velodrome, and something is demonstrably faster when you're actually riding, then you can't really argue with it. It's faster. Then you have to try to understand why, but which is where you can go to the wind tunnel, but it's like you really believe the result.
At which speed, or at what speed, does aerodynamic outweigh watt per kilogram? So even on a 5% climb or something, or when does...
It depends on how many watts per kilo you're doing. Mm-hmm. If you're doing, if you're doing like 8 watts per kilo, then you're going to be going pretty fast on even something like at 10%, you're going to be fast enough that aerodynamics matters.
On a abdu-S climb or something, you're doing 5 to 6 watts per kilogram. Is the normal climbing bike really the fastest for this, or does aerodynamic matters there?
Probably, if you can have the same weight on a TT bike as on your road bike, then the TT bike will be faster. Yeah. But again, like this is something then that we try to present to the riders, is if there's a time trial, for example, with a climb in it, it's that if you're on your road bike, you need to do X number of watts more than your TT bike. So generally, on a road bike, you can do a little bit more power than you can on your time trial bike. Generally, the road bike is a little bit lighter than the time trial bike, and generally, the road bike has slightly worse aerodynamics. So it's always a trade-off, but we try to present to the riders that if you can do 20 watts more on your road bike than you can on your TT bike, then you'll be faster on your road bike. But actually, if you assume that the power that you can do on the road bike is the same as on the TT bike, and the weight is the same, then the TT bike will always be faster because it's more aerodynamic. It doesn't matter how steep it is, but each individual will have a trade-off, like a compromise for riding the TT bike compared to riding the road bike. So you might have somebody where on their road bike they can do 10 watts more than they can on their TT bike, or you might have someone where they can do 50 watts more than they can on their TT bike. If you can do 50 watts more on your road bike, then there's hardly any situation when, as long as you're climbing, it's better on your road bike. But
another question. Now, let's not take a TT bike. So if I think about you, you're doing this crazy race through the Pyrenees, with a lot of hurry. Sorry for that.
Yeah.
Um, So what would be your choice today? A very light bike or a more or less aerodynamic bike frame, I mean, like?
Yeah, so Bjorn's talking here about in a year and a half ago, I did a race called the Trans-Pyrenees. So it was 2,000 kilometers, 6 days, kind of like non-stop through the Pyrenees. So I think 2,000 kilometers with 40,000 meters of climbing. I'm going to do it again this year. I've entered anyway, so we'll see. I'm planning anyway. So because there's so much climbing for that, you just want to optimize for weight as much as possible. Weight and comfort. But actually, when you start to look into it, you can have compromises. You can make compromises on weight for aerodynamics, because although I spend a lot of time climbing, so yeah, I don't climb particularly fast on an event like that because it's so long. I might do, I'm trying to think, between 15 and 18 hours of climbing over the 6 days, which is quite a lot. No, more than that, sorry. Yeah. I climb at like 700 meters an hour. So, yeah, a significant time spent climbing anyway. But you also spend quite a lot of time going downhill as a result of spending so much time going up. So if you can have improvements in aerodynamics without without a weight penalty, then it's definitely worth having as well. So for a really long distance race like that, definitely aero bars were worth it. Definitely, like, as much as possible, like decent jersey, decent helmet, things which don't really have a weight penalty. So yeah, kind of like an aero helmet is decent. You can make small wins anyway.
Yeah.
So for an event like that, this year, hopefully I'll get some sort of lightweight aero bike.
Yeah.
Go from there.
Yeah. So the aerodynamics improvement, it seems like it's getting, you know, we are just like in a rabbit hole, yeah, and the development seems to be like only baby steps anymore, yeah, but I would say the same like 10 years ago, yeah, and you were like, oh, we are doing such great things already. So will it be like that, only baby steps, or is there something in the horizon where we see like, okay, there will be like major eruptions in aero testing? Will there be some new cool things?
I think it's difficult to say, because if I knew what would be cool in 5 years' time,
yes,
I'd be doing it now.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you went back 5 years or 10 years, like, the changes have been huge. Like, look at the wheels; everyone is riding super wide wheels with, yes, like 28-30 millimeter tires. You go back 10 years, everyone is riding tubular tires, like 19 or 21 millimeters. Now everyone's using wax chains, everyone has aero optimized skin suits, or skin suits which are designed to work well above 50 kilometers an hour rather than at different speeds. The future, yeah, I mean, if I knew what it would be, and I told you, I'd have to kill you. But no, but mostly I don't know. But I'm sure that there's plenty that there's left to do. I think that we've only scratched the surface of what's possible.
Yeah. One question is especially for amateurs. So what's the cheapest thing to do in getting more aerodynamic? Not changing your position. Yeah, I mean, like, this is
not changing your position. Yes. Okay.
What's your take on that? I have one.
So,
skin suit.
Skin suit. So I would say the best thing that you can do is get a cockpit that is easily adjustable, that lets you. So if you're doing time trialing, for example, get a cockpit which lets you change the position and get into so that you can really optimize your position.
Yeah.
So you don't even need to go to do aero testing necessarily, but just have something where you can get into every position. You don't want to be limited by your equipment.
Yeah.
And then if you're spending 5, 10, 15,000 euros on a bike, the best thing you can do is to get a cockpit that you can change position of, and then see a bike fitter. It doesn't need to be an aero test necessarily, but just have a good position to start with. Compared to like the difference that you're going to have by spending 1500 euros or 2000 euros on a new set of wheels is going to be so marginal compared to actually being positioned on your bike properly. But when I was doing aero testing previously with Watchop, it was always so frustrating when there were changes that I wanted to make for people and their equipment didn't allow them to do that.
Yeah, and or their equipment is so hairy to handle. Yeah? I mean, like changing aero bars, it's
when it can take it takes like 2 hours or 2 hours to change the position a little bit, and it's like, yeah, if you could do that in 5 minutes, then we could do loads of testing, and then you'd actually know. Yeah. So I think that it's really frustrating to see major bike manufacturers bringing out time trial bikes essentially equipped with equipment with cockpits which you just can't adjust as much as you should be able to. Because it means that you have to buy an aftermarket solution. But try to get a cockpit which lets you adjust it easily. Would be absolute go to.
We both know the pain. Working on screws that hard to get, and then everything falls apart, and you actually need four hands to hold one aero bar. it's horrible. So my take is, or I think also Sebastian's, is the cheapest thing to do is getting some aero bottles on a normal road bike.
That's pretty cheap.
We measured there a lot of improvement. Or maybe a run rider I had, like having a toolbox on your bike, which looks embarrassing, but was actually faster, especially the big ones. that's actually, Niklas, do you have any questions?
What can an amateur do at home to get a better aerodynamic position? So is it a mirror in front of your smart trainer and just see or try to minimize the frontal area?
That's a pretty good starting place.
Okay.
That's really good. Or set up a camera to one side and a camera in front and just film yourself in some different positions and just look at what happens if you change certain things, if you change the stack height, if you change the reach, if you push the saddle further back. Just play around with it try to reduce the size of it as much as you can. Is as good a starting point as any.
Okay.
But also, if it's harder in the UK or it's harder in the Netherlands, but if you're somewhere where you can have access to an outdoor velodrome or if you have a quiet piece of road, then doing just like really basic aero testing is quite nice. It's not something which is really easy to do, but it's worth spending the time. There's actually quite a good podcast from Escape Collective on that with Ronan and Sab Disley on just talking about how to do outdoor aero testing like the first time.
Okay.
Just take the time to do it because it's definitely worth it. In terms of if you're time limited, like improvements per minute spent doing it, it's worth it compared to doing 3 hours on the turbo trainer. Yes. You can have bigger bigger improvements from doing 3 hours of aero testing than you would from 3 hours of training ride.
Okay.
And actually when you're doing aero testing you get training stimulus anyway, so you haven't like lost the training session. Take the time. And if you're just at home, just looking at your position and trying things. So rather than looking at the photo and being like, I don't know what to do with that, like make changes yourself and then see how it looks and see if you think it looks decent. Like try going higher, try going lower, narrower, higher hands. Okay. So rather than just like looking at it and being like, I don't know where to go from here, just make changes and see how it goes, see if it's positive or negative.
And also for like mountain bike races or like Gran Fondo normal road races, would you recommend to always wear an aerodynamic road helmet and skin suit, overshoes, everything you could wear that is more aerodynamic? You should always do this.
Within reason. The only reason why you wouldn't wear like full-on aero helmet, like decent skin suit, is thermal regulation. So,
okay,
if you're don't want to wear super aero helmet with no ventilation if it's going to be 38 degrees, because the improvements from the helmet are going to be quite small, and actually by being a little bit cooler you'll do more power. But
okay.
I would try to aero optimize for everything. So yeah, socks or overshoes, laces on your shoes rather than boa dials. Aero helmet would be good. The only thing with skin suit is just being a little bit careful on like the speeds that it's been optimized for. Yeah. So I know that it gets a bit complicated now, but like mountain bike racing or like cyclocross racing, for example, where your speeds are, let's say 15 to 25 kilometers an hour, has very specific demands compared to like a skin suit, which has been designed for time trialing or track racing, where you're going at 55 to 60 kilometers an hour.
Okay, so there's a measurable difference between a skin suit for mountain biking and a skin suit for road cycling. So it's not the I don't know which brand, but a Caselli skin suit that's optimizing for normal road races is not the fastest one for mountain biking.
Yeah, absolutely. It does make it a little bit harder. So at least one of the brands that I used to consult with was Hoob Design in the UK. So they make a lot of triathlon equipment. One of the products then that we brought out was a triathlon suit with... we designed it for two different speeds. So we had, it's like the sub 22 and the plus 22. So that's miles an hour. So that's like 36 kilometers an hour. So then we had a tri suit, which is optimized for people who are going, like 30 to 36 kilometers an hour for a triathlon. And then another version with different fabrics for people going more than 36, so like 36 to 50 kilometers an hour.
Crazy.
So that's sort of like, I guess when you say like what's going to happen in the next 5 years is you'll see a lot more equipment which is optimized for the specific use cases.
Yeah. I mean, like a sprinter who has top end speed maybe should wear a special skin suit to reach like 65, 70, something like that, to reduce drag. When I think, we didn't talk about that in English, when Andy Zeewald, who's mountain bike champion, world champion, became the year after that second in the world in the worlds, which was a very flat course in Denmark. We also optimized for aerodynamic position on the mountain bike, and that he saved the second place against Sam Gaze. You also know him from Alpecin, which he's a pretty strong guy, and Andreas Zeewald is more or less like 66 kilos, and so we reduced his aerodynamic area to 22 CDA, which was crazy on a mountain bike. It was really, really crazy, but it was very, very aggressive, and that was the only thing that we could reach Gaze after he attacked. And he was quite amazed that this small guy was able to catch him. So it plays a huge role, and the Cape Epic is around the corner, and it's always we also test for that, and testing outdoor. I think most of the listeners know that the app is also working outdoor, so you only need a 1,000 meters of road, pretty flat, and then you can start testing and have a, kind of a good idea what is fast and what is not, and just implement it in your training and start easy, not going with full equipment and everything, just get a feeling how testing works. It's like you really have to learn it.
That's the first time I ever used AeroTune at the time, now Fast U, was just went out with no expectations for the first session. I just want to use it to get familiar with the process. So I think I just did like a road bike 1,000 meters out and back, but like riding really high on the bike and then riding really small on the bike. And just did that like 3 or 4 times just so that I could see how it looked, see how it felt, see how the interface on the Garmin worked before you try to do anything complicated, because if you try to do things which are complicated, you'll start to make mistakes the first time because you're not used to how everything works, and then you'll get pissed off and
it's not working. Okay, I think I had enough questions. Nicholas,
definitely I now need to think about my position on the mountain bike and about the skin suit.
The skin suit, that's for mountain biking, that's difficult. There are definitely options out there, but maybe that's where things will go in the next 5 years.
Slow speed skin suits. Absolutely. Okay. Jamie, thanks thank you for sharing your insights with us today.
No worries. It was
really, really great. Always love to talk with you. So is there anything where listeners can see what you're doing and things like that, except Visma's page and Instagram account and stuff like that?
Probably the Visma Instagram account is the best bet, and then just keep an eye on our results. So hopefully we have some nice punch on results this year.
Okay. All right. Thanks everyone for tuning in, and see you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bjorn. Bye-bye. Thanks, Nicholas. Bye-bye.